Hello, everybody from Jerusalem. Yes, I hope you are now have joined our webinar about the reality, the elections and the reality in East and West Jerusalem. I am Hillel Schenker, and we have two guests who will be our panelists. That's Gershon Baskin and Aziz Abu Sarach. And we are all sitting, I believe, in Jerusalem. I'm in the German colony. And I know that I see that someone says hello from everyone. So it's very good that you're out there and listening to us. We just, about a month ago, had municipal elections in Jerusalem, actually throughout Israel. But in Jerusalem, they were particularly interesting because there was the question of would a Palestinian list run in the Jerusalem municipal elections? And we're going to be getting into that. What happened? What are the potential? What are the possibilities? But I would like now Gershon Baskin, who has been living in Jerusalem for 38 years. I have been spending part of every week for the past 16 years in Jerusalem, but I am a Tel Avivian, an outsider observer. So Gershon, please say a few words about yourself and then describe briefly and concisely the reality in Jerusalem, East and West.
Okay, so good evening, everyone from Jerusalem. Gershon Baskin. As Hillel said, I've been living in Jerusalem for 38 years. I've been in Israel, originally from New York, for the last 40 years, of which all the time that I've been here working on issues of Jewish-Arab coexistence, Israeli-Palestinian peace. I was the founder and co-director of IPCRI, the Israel-Palestine Center for Research and Information, for 24 years, and I've done a lot of other things concerning Jerusalem and other issues. Over the last years, I'm working mostly on the development of renewable energy, a commercial scale renewable energy in Palestine and Egypt. Very briefly, Jerusalem is Israel's largest city, Israel's second poorest city. We have the highest percentage of non-working people in Jerusalem from almost every other city, with the exception of Beitar Elit and Modi'in Elit, which are Haredi cities. Of course, we have a large population of Haredi men who don't work and Palestinian women who don't work. 39% of the residents of the municipality of Jerusalem are Palestinians who are not citizens of Israel, but they are residents of the State of Israel by the act of the government of Israel in 1967 and the law for the entry of the State of Israel, which basically gave them a visa to remain residents in Jerusalem, but it's a conditional visa, as Aziz will tell us more about that. We have in Jerusalem, with the 40%, almost 40% Palestinians, amongst the Jews, probably 25, 26% are ultra-Orthodox Haredi, and the rest are divided more or less equally between those who are considered pluralistic or secular and those who are considered religious or traditional. It is a complex city. I call it a mosaic with lots of different pieces to it that make up the whole beautiful picture, which is Jerusalem, which for me, the beauty is based on its diversity. And unfortunately, that's what most of us learn to hate.
Okay, so now let us go over to Aziz. Aziz, where are you? You're now sitting in East Jerusalem. I'm not sure exactly where.
I'm actually in Washington right now.
Oh, you're in Washington.
Yeah.
If okay, so
the government here, I'm happy to pass it around.
Okay, so obviously here we are in this global village, we're connecting between Jerusalem and Washington, and where all of the rest of you are right now. Do say where you do live when you are in East Jerusalem, and a little bit about what you have been doing. And then please, if you can describe briefly the reality of the Palestinians in East Jerusalem.
Sure. From East Jerusalem, from Wadi Shoz, although I grew up in Bethany El Izariyeh, which is just a couple of miles from the old city, so I And as I said, I do a lot of things. I used to be the chairman of the Bereaved Families Forum, the Israeli Palestinian Parents Circle, people who lost family members in the conflict. My brother was killed in the First Intifada. I've worked in Radio for Peace, where I hosted the shows, and I've worked with National Geographic. I'm an explorer. I hosted a web series called Conflict Zone about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that you can find on YouTube. I do a lot of educational work with them. I co-founded and run a company called Meshdi Tours, which originated an idea of multiple and dual narrative tourism, where every tour almost we have in the country, Israel and Palestine, has two tour guides, one Israeli and one Palestinian, co-leading the trip together. Now we're doing that all over the world. So I'm here in Washington because of the company, and then I'm heading, for example, to Vietnam in a couple of weeks, where we're running trips there, looking at the American-Vietnam conflict. We're running trips in Colombia. We're running trips in Northern Ireland. All kind of areas.
Aziz suggests let's leave Vietnam behind us and get back to East Jerusalem. And please describe what is the reality for the Palestinians in East Jerusalem.
As Gershon said, we are almost 40% of the population of Jerusalem. However, when it comes to budget, for example, we receive only 10% of the budget of the municipality. When it comes to the policy of the city, we don't exist. We are a burden. We are there to pay taxes, but when it comes to our rights, we don't have any of those rights. When it comes to our residency, it's a significant problem. 15,000 of us in Jerusalem have lost our residency because of work abroad, study abroad, travel abroad. People lose their residency, which means we don't really have a permanent residency as Israel claims, but rather a temporary residency that can be taken away not only if you leave to live abroad, but even if you leave to live in Ramallah or Bethlehem or one of these cities. Keep in mind that building in East Jerusalem is almost impossible. Getting a permit to build in East Jerusalem is extremely hard. It's possible, but extremely hard. And since 1967, there have been many new neighborhoods in East Jerusalem, except none of them were built to help the Palestinians in the cities. They were built as settlements for Jewish residents. So that's a little bit of some of the problems in East Jerusalem. I could talk for about probably another 2 hours about issues in East Jerusalem.
Okay, so this leads us to the background of the fact that we just had municipal elections, and you were involved in an attempt to run a Palestinian, the right to vote in elections, but in theory, they do have the right to vote in the municipal elections. And by the way, two things I forgot to mention. One is that I have my awareness of Jerusalem is the fact that I am the Israeli co-editor of the Palestine-Israel Journal, which is a joint Israeli-Palestinian publication based in East Jerusalem. And the second thing I want to mention is that all of you out there will be welcome to ask questions at the end of our discussion. So please, as we're talking, put down your thoughts and questions to be asked later, and the panelists will respond to them. Now let us get to the fact that a month ago we had municipal elections, and I'd just like to mention the fact that last night I was at a Hanukkah party in Tel Aviv where there were about 50 diplomats and 50 peace activists. Gershon will recognize that it was hosted, therefore, by Alice Krieger, and the Norwegian ambassador, who obviously we just marked the 25th anniversary of the Oslo Accords, which the Norwegians helped to host and facilitate. He said he really wished that the Palestinians would run and would vote because it would shake things up and it would ensure that Israelis would understand what is the meaning of a one state Israeli-Palestinian reality.
Hillel, it's interesting because most of the diplomats here, most of the ambassadors and consul generals said that Aziz and I met with them all during the campaign period, and they were all very enthusiastic, but not one of them helped us. Not one.
Yes.
They talk about this democracy, but didn't come to our aid, including very nice Norwegian ambassador.
So they are the cheering section from afar in the bleachers, but they are not actually helping out. I understand that. And on the other hand, I'm getting back first to Aziz and then to you, Gershon, to try to describe what exactly was the dynamic, what happened. But I have to also mention that my Palestinian colleague at the Palestine Israel Journal, Ziad Abu Ziad, who was once the Minister for Jerusalem Affairs on behalf of the Palestinian Authority, he has been one of the people who has been opposed, feeling that Palestinians voting in the elections signifies an acceptance of the forced unification of East and West Jerusalem and essentially of the occupation. So Aziz, please explain what was your motivation and then what happened.
So my motivation to run, I wanted to run for mayor. And then I actually didn't know that I wasn't allowed to run. And I was talking to Gershon, then we called the lawyer. And the lawyer said, oh, you can't run because you are not a citizen. So even though, yes, we have the right to vote in East Jerusalem, but the 40% of us, vast majority of us don't have citizenship, and therefore are not allowed to run for mayor. So we pay taxes, but can't run for the most important position in the city. And yet this was featured as, oh, look, we have democracy, they don't want to vote. That's one. But the other problem we ran into was that most people in Jerusalem, Palestinians in Jerusalem, don't know that they have the right to vote. Because they can't vote for the parliament, they think we can't vote at all. And so one of the issues I have to deal with is talk to people and be able to educate them, which is a totally different reality than any other candidate in through the whole country, where it's not that I want them to vote for me, it's even educate them that they have the right to vote at all, that they have any rights at all in Jerusalem. That's another issue. People didn't know where to go vote. They didn't receive those cards that most Israelis received that tells you which polling station you can go to. So there are a lot of reasons why people didn't vote, and it's not only that they boycotted the elections. Now, there was also two reasons that I think made it worse. One is that the Palestinian government not only told people not to vote, but also threatened and intimidated people, including with violence and threats, and that scared a lot of people. I think it's good that we have disagreements. Ziad and I talked and have this disagreement on whether should Palestinians vote or not. But the moment some elements in the Palestinian leadership decided that violence is a legitimate way to stop people from voting, that's problematic. And the second is, I think the Israeli government did everything possible to make it impossible for people to vote. And my example of being threatened with my residency was sending a message to Palestinians that says, hey, if you think you can use our democracy, think again.
Yeah. Gershon, what's your perspective on what happened?
Well, I think, first of all, the background to it, at least from my perspective, is that I've always believed that Jerusalem needs to be the first issue on the agenda in any Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. Unfortunately, the common wisdom has been always to leave Jerusalem to the very end. And I think that's a mistake. My approach to Jerusalem is that we need to challenge the Israeli and Palestinian publics, the international community, with the reality that exists in Jerusalem. That Jerusalem, whether we have a one-state solution or a two-state solution or a 10-state solution, Jerusalem is a binational city. And the issue of sovereignty is not dealt with at the municipal level. It's dealt with in the national negotiations that will someday take place to figure out what will happen in the city. But within the city, we have a mixed population of different groups, the main ones being Jews and Palestinians. And as such, I have always believed that we need to find ways of bridging the gaps between us, embrace each other, and work together. So going back to 1992, we tried to run a joint Israeli-Palestinian list. We even had a delegation went to Tunis to meet with Yasser Arafat and the executive committee of the PLO, and it was voted down. And in these elections, once again, the idea came up of running a joint list. Aziz and I got together, we announced back in April that we were going to try and run a joint list. And then we spent the month of May going around talking to Palestinian leaders, including Ziad Abu Zayyad and others, who we basically understood that while there might be a chance of running a Palestinian list, a joint list was not going to fly. It was simply too big a gap to jump after 51 years of boycott to go to a joint Israeli-Palestinian list. So sometime in May, we announced that it was going to be a Palestinian-only list. It was going to be run by Aziz, who was going to challenge, again, the Israeli reality and declare that he's running for mayor, planning to go to the Israeli Supreme Court against the law that says that he doesn't have a right to run for mayor. And again, this is a kind of in-your-face moment to challenge this reality, to challenge the Israeli annexation of East Jerusalem. It was never telling the Palestinians that we accept Israeli annexation or Israeli sovereignty. Those issues are not dealt with at the municipal level. It was saying Palestinians are part of the city, Palestinians pay taxes, Palestinians have the right to vote, and they should use that vote. They could determine who could be mayor. We told people there's probably going to be a runoff for mayor, a second round. And if there are enough Palestinians who vote in the first round, we could determine who's going to be mayor of Jerusalem. And you could use that power to get the deputy mayor position, the planning and zoning portfolio, the educational portfolio, to be on the budget committee, to really make a difference in this city. So we had great hopes. We had two public opinion polls that showed one that was done by IPCRI and the Hebrew University that showed something like 60% of Palestinians in Jerusalem thought it was a good thing to participate in these elections. We had a poll that was done by Khalil Shikaki, the leading Palestinian pollster, that showed that more than 20% of Palestinians in Jerusalem planned to run. And we knew that they planned to vote in these elections. We knew that if we had a candidate like Aziz running on a nationalist ticket, a Palestinian national platform, saying that Jerusalem is not an Israeli city, that we don't accept the Israeli annexation, that the movement of the American embassy to Jerusalem is not supported and cannot be done, but presented a plan where Palestinians would have a voice, that we could get at least 20% of the Palestinians to vote. That was the hope. In the end of the day, Aziz withdrew after being threatened both by the Israeli side and the Palestinian side. The other candidates on our list were threatened with violence from the Palestinian side. It became impossible. But it should be noted that there was a Palestinian list that ran in these elections. Unfortunately, his name is Rabbanan Dabash. Fortunately, he's someone that I couldn't support. He was a friend of Nir Barkat, a member of the Likud. He had said on Israeli right-wing television that the annexation of Jerusalem didn't bother him. He could live under Israeli sovereignty. And he's a Palestinian from East Jerusalem who took Israeli citizenship. So I knew that he would not get support. And Palestinians not being uplifted, not being challenged with the need to vote, the voting percentage went from 0.9% 5 years ago to 1.5% in this election. A huge disappointment for us all, I think.
Yeah. Understood. Now, looking towards the future, first focusing on the question of elections are held every 5 years. And I was recently at a meeting where a Palestinian professor at Al-Quds University, who supports the idea of Palestinians voting in the municipal elections, said that what has to be done now is to begin a major educational campaign throughout the 5 years, not just to wait for 5 years from now. So how do you feel about that? How are you looking ahead towards the future?
Just one note, and then I'll turn over to Aziz. In preparation for these elections, we registered an amuta, an NGO called Hukukana, which means our rights in Arabic. And we raised money for the amuta to work on the campaign of awareness and education. And actually the amuta was left with finance, was left with money, and Aziz and the Palestinian colleagues from the list are now taking over Hukukana and developing a plan and a strategy for the next 5 years. Aziz.
Okay, so now let's hear from Aziz what the plan is.
Yeah, I think we have a lot of work to do. I think we started a bit too late in this time, and we learned a lot from what happened and the issues that we face. So there's a lot of work to do on education. There's a lot of work to do on explaining why participating in the election is not normalization, is not accepting Israel's occupation of the city. That actually is the opposite. Right now, with Moshe Leon winning the election, I guarantee you that Palestinians in East Jerusalem for the next 5 years will suffer tremendously. We will have more settlements being built, we'll have more house demolitions, and the people who stood against the elections will have no alternative to offer, no strategy whatsoever. All they could say is, we shouldn't participate in the election. Now, as our city is being taken away from us and being destroyed, we'll watch and see it, and then we'll complain about it. Our strategy is not that. Our strategy right now is, how do we build a community among youth, Palestinian youth? I've been working with already a few people on some ideas and some strategies and how we can use the new nonprofit into education, into also dealing with the Israeli system, into making sure there are people who are interested in running. You need 11 people to be able to run a list. So there's tons of work, and we're starting to work on it.
Before we go into other aspects of the reality in Jerusalem today, I must say that as a Tel Avivian, I'm fortunate to have been in a situation where we had three essentially moderate or left-wing candidates who were the serious candidates for mayor. Ron Huldai, who was re-elected for a fifth term, who was born in Kibbutz Hulda, Asaf Harel, who is like a late night Steve Colbert or John Stewart, whatever, and Asaf Samir. Gershon, maybe you can just say a few words about the two candidates who ended up being in the runoff and what happened between them.
Right, the candidate who lost, Ofer Berkowitz, represented the pluralist segment of Jerusalem society. He was young, one of the youngest candidates in the country for mayor, certainly in the mayor of Jerusalem, in his mid-30s. He was a deputy mayor under Nir Barkat, had conflicts with Nir Barkat. He was a kind of an easygoing person who wanted to preserve the pluralistic nature of Jerusalem. He campaigned largely, but not exclusively, against the threat of the Haredization, of the ultra-Orthodox takeover of Jerusalem. But he also reached out and had support from the ultra-Orthodox community. Moshe Leon, who won, is a person who ran in the election 5 years ago and lost after he had moved to Jerusalem shortly before the elections from Givatayim. He's an accountant. He was at one point director of the prime minister's office under Netanyahu during his first term in office. He's supported by Shas on the one side, and Avigdor Lieberman on the other side. He, though, is not an extremist in any way, not a religious extremist. I wouldn't even call him a right-wing extremist. It was interesting, you know, yesterday was the big demonstrations all over Israel against violence against women. And in Jerusalem at noon, there was a demonstration in Safra Square, in the municipality square. And Moshe Leon, the new mayor of Jerusalem, made his first public appearance as mayor. And he made a very, very good speech about what the municipality will do against the violence against women, including allocating money, allocating staff, social workers, training, awareness. It could have been made by Tamar Zandberg from Meretz, the speech that Moshe Leon made. It was very surprising. This does not mean that he's going to be good on other issues, though, and this is a big concern, because he is in the pockets of the Haredim, and he is going to support the right wing of the Israeli government in building more settlements in Jerusalem.
Yeah. Now, perhaps we can also now get to the question of civil society in Jerusalem, in West Jerusalem and in East Jerusalem. To what degree, Aziz, is civil society active in East Jerusalem, and is there any possibility of joint activity between Palestinian civil society and Israeli civil society, or at this stage does it have to essentially be parallel work, Palestinians working with Palestinians and Israelis with Israelis?
I think at this point, with the anti-normalization calls getting louder and louder, it's much harder to do stuff together, where Israelis and Palestinians working in civil society together. There are some, and I applaud them. I think this is important. But I think if you're going to do a work that will reach a lot of people in Jerusalem, the civil society in the eastern side and Al-Quds has to work parallel to the one on the Israeli side, has to work on, and there are some. The problem, in my opinion, civil society is not there to replace government. And what the civil society in East Jerusalem is trying to do is to replace the Israeli government services. And they fail at it. That is impossible. You can't really give all the services. We have 2,000 classrooms missing in East Jerusalem. Civil society is not going to be able to meet that. We have problems with the curriculums in East Jerusalem. Civil society is not going to be able to deal with that because it's an issue decided by the government. The housing problem. We have 140,000 Palestinians now living outside the wall in East Jerusalem. 140,000, that's about a third of East Jerusalem. And civil society isn't going to be able to deal with that. So we have to also figure out what civil society can and cannot do and not expect from civil society, which, as you mentioned in the beginning, are not getting even that much funding anymore. Not the Europeans and not the Americans are willing to give much money to these civil society organizations. They're not going to be able to do all the work needed. That's why it cannot be only civil society. It needs to be parallel. It needs to be civil society on one end, and it needs to be political work on the other end. And if you separate the two, you end up losing. I think what we need the most in East Jerusalem, probably from the civil society on both sides, is a better working, strategizing together, thinking together, who can do what, how can we work together for the better of the city. I think there is a feeling among some that, oh, if East Jerusalem does well, that's bad for West Jerusalem. And that's nonsense. We have to work together on a strategy that is good for all the residents, but politically it does not exclude us in East Jerusalem, and rights-wise does not exclude us. I'm not into figuring out what the final solution is going to be between the Israelis and the Palestinian government, but until that's figured out, I am into making sure that my family, everybody I know, my friends who live in Jerusalem have their rights, are not completely... have no chances to succeed in that city.
Khalil, I think it's also important. I think it's also important to mention that more than 80% of Palestinians living in East Jerusalem are living under the poverty line. Civil society and civil society organizations and actions done by civil society is really a luxury in a situation where you're struggling to put food on the table, where you're struggling to keep a roof over your head, where you can't afford to pay the municipal taxes. In a situation where just yesterday the Israeli Minister of Social Affairs of Welfare announced that social workers who have graduated Al-Quds University cannot be employed by the government of Israel, the municipality of Jerusalem. There's a lack of social services. There's real poverty. There's real a really desperate situation in East Jerusalem. The people are really afraid of being able to stay in the city and maintain a life here.
Okay, before I get to the next area in question, I'd just like to remind all of the people who are joining in on this discussion that soon you will be able to ask questions, but that you cannot do it with your microphone. You have to do it there is an icon which says Q&A or question and answer, and there you should be writing. And that apparently you can only do on a computer and not on a mobile phone, if I understand correctly from the tech people. So please get ready to type in your questions in the Q&A area. And now to get back, Gershon, it was mentioned the issue of anti-normalization, and both you and I happen to be in joint organizations, some of the few that remain, Palestine-Israel Journal, Israelis and Palestinians working together, putting out a publication. And you are IPCRI, of course, which is a joint Israeli-Palestinian research and think and do organization. How do you perceive this issue of anti-normalization and how to deal with it?
Yeah, I think there's a very big issue on the Palestinian side that needs a lot of clarification and needs a lot of nuance. in the understanding of the society. It seems to me to be completely counterproductive for Palestinians to decide that cooperating with people like you and me and organizations that we work with that have worked against the occupation since 1967, have worked for Palestinian rights, support Palestinian national rights, that we should be considered normalizers. I have never done anything to normalize the occupation. We have worked against the occupation. So I think this is part of the dialogue that we need to continue to do with Palestinians. I can tell you from my own experience, and now I've been working for the last 4 years in renewable energy, and everyone, I work with the Palestinian Authority directly, the energy ministry, and municipalities, and many, many, I was in Jenin 2 days ago, and this morning in Jericho, and all over the West Bank. When people determine that there's a benefit that's going to be clear, where it's not just dialogue, not just a bunch of people sitting around talking, but actually something is going to come from it that's going to provide a benefit for Palestinian society, for the economy, to create jobs, to give people education and career development, the anti-normalization discussion moves out of the picture. So I think that we need to rethink some of the things that we're doing also and think about how we go beyond dialogue to something that's going to impact people's lives, and we'll get a lot less resistance on this anti-normalization stuff.
Yes. Now, I can't resist asking you also, are you committed to remaining in Jerusalem? Because as you know, there are many secular liberal Israelis who are just, I don't know whether to call it giving up or going to freer pastures, to the coast, to Tel Aviv, Modi'in, whatever.
I love to come and visit Tel Aviv and to enjoy its non-kosher restaurants and have a great time. I'm not leaving Jerusalem. Jerusalem is my home. There's no place in the world that I want to live more than Jerusalem.
Yeah, but
okay. I'll ask the same thing, Aziz.
Can you give me a second? Is that question is really important because Gershon can go out of Jerusalem and can come back whenever he wants. A Palestinian in Jerusalem does not have that luxury. And perhaps it's explaining how different the realities we live in is if my nephew gets a scholarship to go study in the States, he has to think 10 times about accepting such a scholarship, because by being abroad for a certain amount of time, he might not be allowed back in. The fact is, the moment I took a job that isn't travel, now that's why I was mentioning here, I'm going to Vietnam and Colombia, the fact that I'm doing that puts my whole residency in Jerusalem under question. The fact that you become successful is a problem for the state. And that's why we have 80% of people below poverty level. Not because people want to be poor, it's because you're not given any chance to succeed. You can't just study in Palestinian universities and get a job in the workforce in Israel, but you don't make enough money to go study in Hebrew university because it costs a lot more. You can't get any scholarships. You can't get any opportunities abroad to go a few years and come back. And that's the reality that we live in. And that's the reality we have been trying to challenge and continue trying to challenge. Is if really we want to move forward, Palestinians in Jerusalem need to be given a fair chance.
Yes, no question about it. And there is actually, there is a right-wing fantasy that continuing this situation of discrimination and deprivation will, and in the end, convince the Palestinians to leave East Jerusalem. And yet you have Sumud, you have, you know, is that fantasy, is there any basis to that?
There is a basis to that. I think the basis to that is a lot of people ended up moving to live beyond the wall. And that happened because it's impossible to live within. You can't build any more housing in the Palestinian sites. Ironically, though, some Palestinians started buying houses in some of the settlements in East Jerusalem, like Beit Gazeev and Neve Yaakov. These are kind of less ideological settlements, so it's possible for some Palestinians to buy housing there. So in some end, it backfired that they're not allowing Palestinians to build. But those who move beyond the wall, there have been talks in the Knesset about disconnecting these Palestinian neighborhoods beyond the wall from Jerusalem. And if that happens, you drop the number of Palestinians in Jerusalem from 340,000 to about 200,000 people So that's the goal, is how can we minimize the number of Palestinians in Jerusalem? I think what's frustrating to me, I expect that from a right-wing Israeli government. What doesn't make sense to me is how little there is work on the Palestinian government side, the Palestinian leadership side, to challenge that. It's like as if this doesn't exist. And those of us who are trying to challenge it are being called names and being called, you're not standing in the Palestinian line, and you're living Israel, you're normalizing. And that's such a BS, because if you don't have an alternative, then let those who have ideas do their work instead of just being armchair critics.
Well, one of the factors that we're all dealing with, and definitely that you are dealing with, is that in the Oslo Accords, one of the elements in the accord was that the Palestinian Authority that was established in the wake of the Oslo Accords has no authority in East Jerusalem. And obviously, right, that's a major problem.
And they accepted that, which from a Palestinian perspective is extremely frustrating, that they would agree that they would have no connection to us in East Jerusalem. I mean, to make Palestinians able to vote in the Palestinian parliamentary election back in 2006 was a major fight between the, it took the Americans to eventually convince the Israeli government to let them vote. But that's another issue, is, I mean, being a Palestinian in East Jerusalem, we're dealing with the oppression from the Israeli government, and we're dealing with completely being ignored by the Palestinian government and having no opportunities on either side. We can't run for mayor in Jerusalem legally. I can't run for any office in the Palestinian side, because last time we had elections was 2006. So in some ways, we can't get anybody to represent us. We can't get our voices anywhere. And if you are as young as me, you have zero chance to really get involved in decision-making. You have to be appointed to a position, and to get appointed, you have to be like-minded. You can't challenge the way of thinking that exists, not on the Israeli side, not on the Palestinian side.
Yep. Also, Hillel, it's important to remember that the Oslo Accord that was signed that prevented the Palestinian Authority from having authority in Jerusalem was a five-year interim agreement. And during that five-year period, the government of Israel had agreed that the Orient House, working under the PLO flag, would continue to represent Palestinian interest in Jerusalem, and Israel closed the Orient House run by Faisal Husseini. And in the roadmap for peace that was issued by President George W. Bush, the Israelis were supposed to reopen Palestinian institutions in Jerusalem, including the Orient House and the East Jerusalem Chamber of Commerce. So there are no representative bodies. It was not meant to be a long-term deal. The Israelis cynically passed a law in the Knesset called the Law for the Implementation of the Oslo Agreement. And under the Law for the Implementation of the Oslo Agreement, they arrested Palestinian officials from having any right to even function in Jerusalem.
Yes. Now, we're going to one more question, and then we're going to get into the Q&A. So please, everyone out there, get ready to start writing. And this question or comment is the fact that with everything that we have described, the Palestinians in East Jerusalem who are working, if my statistics are correct, 40% of them are working in West Jerusalem. And I experience it directly also, because half of the taxi drivers in Jerusalem are Palestinian. So this is another element in the complex reality of Jerusalem. Perhaps a comment about that, Gershon.
It's even up to 50% of the workforce in East Jerusalem, yep, makes their living either in West Jerusalem or in Israel. And that's part of the economic reality. The GDP, even though Jerusalem is the second poorest city in Israel, the per capita GDP in Israel is $40,000, as opposed to $3,000 in the West Bank and something like $5,000 or $6,000 in East Jerusalem. So the gaps, the economic opportunities, are on the Israeli side, not on the Palestinian side. So anyone who can get a job, who can move, have the access, will try and work on the Israel side.
Okay, now all of you out there, you've had a lot of input of information and analysis, and it's now your turn to ask questions, make comments, so please write them in.
We have three questions up so far.
We do. I don't see them.
I do.
I don't see any either.
If you push the Q&A, There are three questions, two from Edith Garwood and one from Camila.
For some reason,
did I read the question?
I don't see it. So maybe Edith, you can read it out.
This is a good question for you, Aziz. Could you speak on if and how archaeological tours, digs, parks are used as a displacement tool of Palestinian communities in East Jerusalem?
Could you speak on if and how archaeological tours, digs, parks are used as displacement tools? Well, there are some of those. I think archaeology, this could take for a while, I think archaeology in a general is a problematic thing because it's a form of getting your connection to a place, but also it could be a form of denying somebody else's connection to the place. And when you dig in Jerusalem, the first level, what you're going to find is often Muslim history, because we have the Ottomans, the Mamluks, and the Umayyads, and the Abbasids. And if you want to go any lower, you have to dismantle those. So if you want to reach the Second Temple period or the First Temple period, you have to dismantle the earlier stuff. And any time from a Palestinian who's in conflict with the state that doesn't see him as belonging to this place, anytime they dismantle some of that, it's a message that often tells people you don't belong here. And that's, even if it's done purely for archaeological purposes, that's how it comes. Now, there are other examples. There's a land, maybe one of the few pieces of land left between Al-Mutala, the Augusta Victoria Hospital, and Al-Isawiyah. A piece of land that's not that special, but it's one of the few pieces of land where you can still build on. However, a few years ago, the government decided to make this land as a national park. There's no reason to make it a national park. I've never heard of anybody going there to look at the beauty of that piece of land, but it's the only natural place for Isawiyah, one of the Palestinian neighborhoods, to grow there. And so these are some ways. Another way, by the way, is declaring land as military bases. That happened not just in East Jerusalem, happened just recently in the Jordan Valley. And then after a couple of years saying, oh, we don't need the military base anymore, we will turn it into a settlement. So that happens, unfortunately, quite often.
But I think that the two best examples of the danger of using the archaeological and historical sites as tools of displacement are the fact that in Jerusalem we have a political organization, El Ad, which was given the basically ownership and management of the National Park of the City of David. And this is taking a private political organization and turning it into a national authority. It's very interesting when you look in the phone book and you find the telephone number for El Ad and the phone number for the National Park in the City of David. They're two different phone numbers, but they're answered by the same person. So it's two associations in one. And of course, El Ad is working on displacing of Palestinians in Silwan, where they're digging underneath Silwan and probably want to dig underneath El Aqsa, underneath the Temple Mount. And El Ad is, together with Ateret Kohanim, in the process of purchasing apartments from Palestinians and homes from Palestinians to displace them, and they offer them huge amounts of money and entice them to leave. There's a big case going on right now. These are all actions aimed at displacement.
Okay, now to remind everybody that to ask a question, you have to go into the Q&A icon and write something. And since I can't see the questions, Gershon, okay, what is the next question?
We have Camila who asks, we've just learned that the Israel Anti-Boycott Act is being reintroduced in the lame duck session of the U.S. Congress. Please share your thoughts on that.
Okay, so?
Do you want me to answer that, or you, Gershon?
I think that boycotting Israel and supporting BDS, which I don't do, I think it's a legitimate act of resistance, a legitimate act of free speech and free thought. And I think it's ridiculous to make it illegal for someone to boycott. I grew up on boycotts. I boycotted grapes and lettuce when I was a kid. I boycotted South African products during the time of apartheid. I personally boycott Israeli settlements, and I support boycotting Israeli settlements. And I think to make it illegal to participate in a boycott is against democracy, is against what I believe in.
Yes.
All right.
Okay.
There's another question here that says, I sent in a question previously about the fact that Jerusalem is the center of the three states. Does this not bear any weight at all? If not, why not? I think it does. It's important that what makes Jerusalem, or one of the reasons that makes Jerusalem a very special place, is that it is the heart of Christianity, Islam, Judaism. I think we have, and there are people who do share the city and be able to appreciate the differences and be able to see that we can live together. It's not an exclusive place. Jews, Muslims, and Christians have at some point lived together very well and have at other points, unfortunately, dominated each other and oppressed each other. And the question is, in this point of time, are we going to be able to coexist together, or is one group going to oppress the other? It's the way it's going right now is not the way I would like to see it. I work with the Christians and Jews. My company hires Muslims, the Christians and Jews, Israelis, Palestinians, everybody, and we try to use our model, our business model, same with some of the civil society mentioned here, as an example of saying, here's what we can do together. We can work together. We can get along together. We can live together, and it doesn't have to be one or the other. I can give you so many different stories from the wedding of Gershon's daughter, where the person who officiated a Jewish wedding was a Palestinian co-guide of his son-in-law. Of when my dad went to the hospital for heart surgery, the first person who came to check was a friend of ours, who was a rabbi. He came with his kippah, asking where the room for Muhammad is, which confused everybody in the hospital. There are some great examples that happening of where that Christians, Muslims, and Jews can come together. We need many more, but we need to also influence policy to make that work.
I think that the big problem that we face is, of course, the holy places, and mainly the Temple Mount, Al-Aqsa compound. And here we have the center of the conflict, the heart of the conflict, the most important religious site to Muslims and Jews here. And unfortunately, as years have gone on with the continuation of the conflict and the violence of the conflict, we've seen the issue of acknowledgement of the importance of this holy site to both faiths as being somewhat mutually exclusive. Where I know from a conversation I had with the Chief Justice of the Sharia Court in Palestine, who I asked him, is there a problem of the prohibition of Jewish prayer on Al-Aqsa, on the Temple Mount, because of Sharia, because of Islamic law? And he said, no, there's nothing in Sharia which prohibits a Jew from praying in Al-Aqsa. The problem is political. The problem is one of control. But unfortunately, Palestinians over the years have entered into a period of Judaism Jewish connection to this holy place, which creates greater animosity amongst the Jews, who want exclusivity over their holy places. We have this whole issue of Jewish prayer on the Temple Mount. This is something which is going to have to be postponed to a later time. We need to have open access to all the holy places for everyone in the world of any faith. A holy place should be holy to everyone. We can have exclusivity, but we need to have mechanisms where we can control these places in a way that's not going to be bringing conflict between us.
Now, I'd like to add here, my own personal utopian view is that I would wish that Tel Aviv could be the capital of the state of Israel, and Ramallah would be the capital of the future state of Palestine, and Jerusalem would be going back to the original partition plan, an international city. Now, unfortunately, I realize that that utopian vision is unrealistic because the overwhelming majority of the Israelis and of the Palestinians and of the Arab world would not accept that. So we have to work out a solution for Jerusalem, which will take into account also the national alongside the religious sensitivities of both sides. And we should remember that King Hussein, Jordanian King Hussein, said the old city should essentially be God's city. Under the auspices with the Muslims, the Christians, the Vatican also has some say there as well.
You know, Hillel, in Camp David in July of 2000, President Clinton offered to Yasser Arafat that Jerusalem, or the holy places in Jerusalem, be placed under divine sovereignty, as he called it, To which Yasser Arafat responded, "Mr. President, with all due respect, when you're willing to put the White House under divine sovereignty, we'll be willing to put Jerusalem under divine sovereignty."
Okay, so now let's try to look at
another question. You person, David, asked what segment of Israel are most likely to see engagement in Jerusalem politics as offering a serious payoff? Who is not immune to changes of and
the charges?
Charges of, I don't know. I think what Gershon mentioned earlier is in the polls, there have been serious number of Palestinians in Jerusalem willing to engage in the politics in Jerusalem. However, they don't see how. If you can't run for the most important position in the city, that's not real engagement. If you're being told you only have your own space to engage in, that's not really paying off. So we have to work kind of in both, in parallel ways of saying, yes, we want to be engaged in politics, but we really want to be engaged in politics and not just being a fig leaf, not just saying, oh, here we are doing this for no purpose at all. Now, I do think we have a lot of power that we haven't utilized. For example, in the last elections between Berkovich and Moshe Leon, the runoff, the difference in votes between the winner and the loser was only a few thousand votes. Palestinians in East Jerusalem who have the right to vote are about 180,000. We literally could decide, if it's not even one of us, we could decide who the mayor is. We could decide who controls the city council. If we decide to go and vote in big numbers, that would change the politics in Jerusalem completely. Now, if one of us runs for mayor and able to run for mayor, we actually have that ability to win that position, which would, I understand, scare off a lot of Israelis. But the fact is, I've been living all my life under an Israeli Jewish mayor. I don't see why not Israelis be okay with living under a Palestinian mayor. I mean, at least I do speak fluent Hebrew, unlike all the mayors of Jerusalem so far, who none of them spoke fluent Arabic. And I hire Israelis and Palestinians, which is, again, none of them do that in their own private businesses. So I think we could do that. It takes thinking, having a visionary thinking and strategic thinking of saying, let's not just look at what that means now and how some people might interpret it, but rather look at the major effect it will have and peace in the whole area and how it will impact Israelis and Palestinians as a whole.
I think also, Aziz, it's important to mention that there are, I think, this semester, about 600 Palestinians from East Jerusalem studying at the Hebrew University. There are, I understand, about 2,000 Palestinians who are studying at Israeli colleges. And the number of Palestinians in East Jerusalem who are now studying the Israeli curriculum rather than the Palestinian curriculum is increasing. Last year was 10%. The projection is next year will be about 15%. The reason they're studying the Israeli curriculum is to get accepted to the Israeli universities and the Israeli colleges where people think they'll have a better career chance in the future, not because they're becoming Israelis, but this is the reality. And those thousands of people who are getting into the Israeli system, in addition to the 50% of workers from East Jerusalem who work in West Jerusalem, these are all potential people who can be convinced to see the importance of voting in the election and the benefits that could come as a result of that. And they're not going to be called collaborators. No one in Palestine who's working to better themselves, to put food on the table, to have a career, to have an education, are called collaborators.
Right.
Yes. I would add also that, from my understanding, at least half of the students at Hadassah College in many of the departments are Palestinians from East Jerusalem.
Amongst the 2,000 who are studying in colleges in West Jerusalem.
Yeah. Now, so as we near the ending of this discussion, I'd like to ask the basic question of both of you. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the future of Jerusalem? So let's begin with you, Gershon.
It's my city. How can I be pessimistic about it? It's a city with a lot of challenges, a lot of difficulties. Someday, people are going to understand, like me, that the beauty of the city is in its diversity. And when, like me, you can celebrate the diversity of the city, you'll appreciate how wonderful this city is. That's what I'm working for. That's what I believe in. And I believe because there is so much beauty in the diversity here and so much to celebrate, Israelis beginning to discover it in the culinary area of ethnic food, of different communities that here. I could not imagine Jerusalem without its Palestinians in Jerusalem. It just would be a horrible city. So the richness of the city because of the culture that exists here. There's a whole scene that people don't talk about of youth culture in East Jerusalem, of Palestinian music and Palestinian art and Palestinian literature that's developing it places for this to take place. And when I go to these events, I'm surprised all the time seeing young Israelis there too, appreciating it. So I'm optimistic.
Okay, and Aziz, what about you?
I don't know how to not be optimistic. So I think I'm optimistic because despite everything I've gone through with running for mayor and all the opposition and all the government opposition, I've met so many people who are supportive, so many people on the Israeli side, so many people on the Palestinian side who are supportive, and especially among young people. Among young Palestinians who are coming and saying, finally, somebody is giving us an idea. Finally, there is a vision. Finally, we can engage with something. And seeing those people give me a lot of hope because I know there are those who are looking to do something. And I'm still in touch with many of those young people who want to do something, and I want to work with them. And regardless what I do 5 years from now, I don't know if it's something I'll be running for, but I know there'll be those who will, among those young people who I've met in the last few months.
Okay, any last comment from either of you?
I'm afraid that in the next elections in 5 years from now, I probably won't be running again or trying to run again, but I support not only encouraging Palestinians to run in the next election, but using these 5 years to also try and create the reality where we can run a joint Israeli-Palestinian list in the next municipal elections 5 years from now in Jerusalem.
Well, you know, if Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden are both considering running in 2020, so you shouldn't give up either. And Aziz?
I'm good. I just think what's really important to me is that people hear those stories, take them, tell them to others. I find it frustrating sometimes as I travel that people don't know about the Palestinians in East Jerusalem, don't know the challenges we go through, and don't know the things that we can offer, both Palestinian Christians and Palestinian Muslims who live in the city. So I hope you can take those stories that we have shared and be able to spread them around.
Okay, and to close, first of all, I'd like to thank both you, Aziz, and Gershon, and I'd like to invite all of you who are out there listening, watching, asking questions, to come visit Jerusalem. Come see the reality in East and West Jerusalem, and also, if possible, participate in changing that reality. So thank you.